just like put on the table is that I'm not here to talk about how we're meant to react to such a tragedy. It's not my business, to tell anybody, and there's lots of Rabbanim and Gedolei Yisrael, etc., who are there to tell us what to do. I'm more like just, Rabbi Liff asked me to share some memories about Rabbi Twersky, and then maybe some like a Moser Haskell that we could take out of there. But personally, for me, it's more an issue of like, I guess, sharing the way I feel about it. So if it sounds like I'm saying something, which is this is what we should do, it's more just that's emotionally how I'm reacting, and I'm sharing it with you. But in terms of what each person feels they should or shouldn't do, you ask your local Orthodox rabbi or Gadol B'Torah, etc. Okay, I wanted to bring some Sishon with me. Apparently I forgot it. It's fine. I'll just say about that. Mesos Yisharim says at one point, I think in Perek Yud-Gimel, that most people cannot reach the high levels of Avodas Hashem that really, Be'etzem is the way it should be, so to speak. The way Avodas Hashem really should be. Most people can't reach that. So he says, but there are a few people, the Yechidei Segula, as he calls it, that do. They can and they do. He says, this is the concept that we find in Chazal every now and then called Mishnas Chasidim. So they can and they do. And he says, what happens is that uplifts the rest of Klal Yisrael. Everybody else is lifted up by these people. So I was just thinking, and it's based on a concept I heard once from Rav Yaakov Weinberg on a tape. How does this work? The way it works is that Klal Yisrael are Revim Zebazeh. Klal Yisrael, really, Knesset Yisrael is one goof, is one entity, one body. And when you have someone who's exceptional in Avodas Hashem, so it's not the pshat that he exists within a vacuum, or she, for that matter. It's not that they exist independent of Klal Yisrael. There's the rest of us yokels, and then there's this, wow, this amazing person. No, this is Klal Yisrael at its best. This person is a manifestation, an expression of the best part of Klal Yisrael. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, I heard quoted, I didn't see it inside. He said, if a person doesn't know his own failings, his own his downsides, his chesronos, then he's in trouble. It's not good. But if he doesn't know his own milus, if he doesn't know the positive aspects of himself, then he's completely crippled. So, in that sense, to me, there's many reasons why it's very important to talk about a Gadol B'Torah, right, who is Nifter. But the part that I relate to the most, on a personal level, is this facet, that this is Klal Yisrael at its best. This is not him and us. This is all of us at our best. And this is particularly so when something like this happens and it hit all of us, each of us in our own way and on different levels. But it hit everybody, as this is not just, the personal tragedy of this individual, or these four individuals, or numerous individuals, right, and their families. This was something that was, this was Klal Yisrael. That's what everybody's been talking about. These were the korbanos of Klal Yisrael, and those that are suffering are the korbanos of Klal Yisrael in that sense. So, we didn't know him on the broad global scale during his lifetime because he was a nister. He really, just kept to himself, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. But apparently, HaKadosh Baruch Hu arranged that at least when he died in such a way that we would come to know him. So let's try to come to know him a little bit. So, first thing is a little background information. He was a very interesting person. He was the Nin Veneched of the Tolna dynasty, right, which goes back to the Chernobyl dynasty, which is from one of the Iker Talmidim of the Besh, of the Baal Shem Tov. His grandfather was the Tolna Rebbe in Boston or something like that. Maybe his father also was a little bit of a Rebbe. The kids are, if you would have gone by the lineage, so he really should have been the Tolna. Or a Tolna Rebbe. As a matter of fact, in Teres Moshe, otherwise known as Tomo, most of the guys would endearingly refer to him as the Rebbe for this reason and other reasons. So, it wasn't just his lineage. He very much embraced Teres HaChasidus. Teres HaChasidus was Taifes, a very, very big makom in who he was and the way that he went about his Avodas Hashem. On the other hand, He was also a grandson of Rabbi Yosef Dov Soloveitchik of Boston, also Yeshiva University, who was a son of Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, grandson of Rav Chaim Brisker. And he learned by that Rabbi Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, and he also learned by Rav David Soloveitchik from Yerushalayim. And he was not just kind of the Torah of Brisk, it became his lifeblood. It completely defined who he was. So this is like a very interesting study of contrasts. It's not something that you would naturally expect that could go together. And, you know, I'm sure most of us have seen people like this. These like, you know, Litvische Hasidische type of people where like, you know, you see, he's got a little bit of this, a little bit of that. Sometimes it seems like it contradicts a little bit, maybe sometimes. But amazingly, he managed to put it together. And it wasn't just like, you know, sometimes you say, okay, he had the Koyach HaSeichel of Brisk and he had the Hislavos of Chernobyl. It wasn't like that. In his hashkafas, his hashkafas were very, very, very much built based on the Hasidus that he grew up with and that he lived with and that he learned very much deeply. His hanhagas as well, everything. He was completely the hashkafa of Brisk and completely the hashkafa of Hasidus at the same time. And was not a steerer. He managed, I mean, he was a brilliant, brilliant individual, really. And it runs in the family. I mean, if anybody heard any of the Shirim of his brother, Yibadul Chaim, Rabbi Meir Tversky from YU. He also is a very brilliant individual. I mean, seems to really run the family. Probably from both sides of the family. From both sides of the family. So, the Tversky side and the Soloveitchik side. So he was an incredibly brilliant person, and he had an incredibly huge heart, and he really did put it together. He put it together in a way which was lahafli. You know, it was, as they say in English, it was streamlined. It was streamlined. It didn't look like, you know, there were catchy, you know, tefer marks, if you will, along the way. He really managed to put it together. So, you know, the eager thing that everybody talks about is this Koyach HaTorah. Chazal said there's something called the Sinai and there's something called an Iker Hardin. The Sinai is the big bucky. He's the one who knows everything, right? You know, Kol Mitzvos HaTorah, Shas, Paiskim, Nigla, Nisr, everything. He knows everything. And then there's someone called an Iker Hardin, someone who's a very, very sharp person. His Koyach HaSvar is phenomenal. It's very rare to find someone who really, really, really embodies both of these. And one thing that Kulei Alma Moedu is that he did. He did. You could not catch him anywhere. You could bring up any sugya anywhere, and he's completely holding as if like he just finished learning it. And I'm not talking about just like, you know, be'erach, you know, holding in the topic in general. I'm talking, you know, he could tell you the machlekes of how to understand Shita Sarambam in the sugya. He could tell you the three mahalchim of the Achrayim and the Tzarachian on each one of those mahalchim. He was mamish holding. Really, really holding. And it wasn't just the bekiyas. He had everything worked out. You know, it wasn't so easy always to get out of him how he had it worked out. But everything was bekiyus lahafli and amkus lahafli. It really was. I mean, I've come into contact with a lot of big people in my life, and I don't think I've met, except for maybe one other person, I don't think I've ever met someone that is that incredibly holding in both the bekiyus of Torah and the amkus of Torah. I heard a maisa, I didn't verify myself, I heard a maisa that there was a Talmud Chacham who told people that he used to call Rabbi Tversky from time to time to share a chiddush that he came up with. And he stopped doing it. And he told them, he said, why did I stop? Because every single thing that I thought of, you know, I chapped, you know, he would catch me in the middle, right? Yeah, he already thought of it. So there was no point. I stopped. One of the Talmidim said that one time, night seder, he asked him to get a Gemara for him. He said, Rabbi, which Gemara? And he said, anyone. Anyone. When, after the World Trade Center was destroyed, so everybody was talking about the tragedy and how to relate to it, how to understand it. So he, on Friday's year, which is when we broaden the topics and talk about other things, so he based himself on some obscure for those that don't know, obscure psukim in Tzfanya. You know, that was what came to mind, some psukim in Tzfanya that talk about like mighty buildings falling. And one time there was a guy who was also a very big bucky, or an up and coming, you know, maybe someone who could be like him in another 10 years. He one time was miyashiv v'sugyo based on his ideas from Nach with Sancheirim and all these different things, and Rav Tversky was so impressed, and he said, wow, what the key is. You know, he really appreciated every single aspect, whether it was Gemara, whether it was Nach, whether it was Musar, whether it was Ashkafa, Nigla, Nister, everything. His mamish is, it wasn't just he had a yad in everything, he was mamish roishay v'rubay in everything. He was an incredible masnid. is something one of the Talmidim who spoke by the Levi and also spoke by the Kenneth that they made in Teres Moshe two nights ago. So he mentioned that Rebbe never went to lunch. Now, as he said that, I had a tikkun where I learned this in B'chavrusa from morning seder. Right, my morning seder chavrusa dumped me, and to do me a favor, he didn't want to just dump me, so he arranged that I would learn with Rabbi Tversky. That was nice of him. So, Rabbi Tversky's chavrusa that he learned with for kimat 15 years straight, Chesky Lang, who I also overlapped with in Teres Moshe, he was away in Lakewood trying to get married. When he came back, he obviously reclaimed his chavrusa. I was in the mirror already by then, but in any event, so. When he said it, when Mattisfeld said this, all of a sudden it dawned on me, yeah, of course, I never saw him go to lunch. You know, he had his little bag of like coffee grounds and his little bag of snack, whatever it was, that he would sometimes, you know, make himself a coffee or take a snack if he really needed to. But other than that, he didn't go to lunch. He didn't eat. You know, and the Rebbetzin spoke about this a lot also. What struck me more was the fact that it never struck me until Mattisfeld pointed it out to me. And then I realized, a lot of people said things that surprised me. He was apparently a very big parush, and I never realized it. Mamish a parush, kipshutay mamish. He was parish mitanu yayel mazer in a way which is really completely beyond the concepts of this generation. And I couldn't help but be almost bewildered by the fact it never hit me that Rebbe was a parush. So what's the pshat? My pshat is that I think, I could be wrong, but I think that the Iker, it wasn't the pshat that, you know, Lashin Precious, he didn't go to eat lunch. It's that he loved learning Torah so much, and learning Torah for him was like being a fish being in water. He couldn't be bothered. He just could not be bothered to pull himself away to go sit down and have a formal break from his learning by go and having lunch in the middle of the day. He just couldn't. He needed to learn. The Rebbetzin said over the course of the Shiva many times, well, not many times, a few times, she said how during the week, throughout the week, she basically lived alone, independent. She said she would come home after, you know, in the more recent years when all of her kids, except for her youngest son, Avrami, who's away in yeshiva all the time, came out. She said she would come home, cold, dark house. She would eat by herself, go to sleep by herself. She had no idea what time her husband came home. In the morning, he would wake up early, sometimes go to the mikveh before davening. Punkt on the day that he was murdered, he did go to the mikveh before davening. And she said, you know, he came out, was never around, because he was learning all the time. She came out for someone. Shabbos and Yontif, that was like her chiyus. Her chiyus was Shabbos and Yontif. And she was particularly, you know, okay, whatever, we don't need to get into that right now. So, you know, his oldest son, Meshulam, said something that, you know, even knowing how much of a master he was, I never would have imagined such a thing. He said, in my entire life, I never saw my father go to sleep on Shabbos. He said, I would wake up sometimes at 2 in the morning, 3 in the morning, he'd still be learning. His youngest son, Avrami, said that he once told him, he said, the time on Shabbos is just too precious. I can't use it for sleep. He also mentioned, I didn't catch whether this was on Shabbos during the week, that one time, you know, he noticed that his father was about to go to sleep and then his alarm clock went off. You know, so this is who he was. My other Iker Rebbe, Yibadu L'chaim Tovim, Rav Aaron Lopiansky, told me, he was once telling me how Rav Volba said that for most people, by the time you turn 30, you either get a job or get dead. Because most people, they need something tangible by that time in their life. They can't just go, you know, the nitzchis of Torah la'analoi me'olamim, most people can't relate to that. They can't do it. He said, there are very few people, this is the way my Rebbe said, there are very few people that you could stick them in the middle of a midbar, give them a gemara and a shtender, and they'll be happy. Very, very few people. Very, 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 very few people. He said, Ritorsky is one of them. Ritorsky is one of them. You could just push it, put him in the middle of the midbar with nothing else. He once said to me something that to this day I cannot fathom. He said to me that it's possible that a married person can learn more as married than as a bachur. Now, most of you in this room are not married, so it could be that you don't relate to that statement. But those of us that are in the room that are married probably share my sense that how in the world is it possible for someone to say such a thing? Now, obviously, it speaks tremendous volumes about the Rebbetzin. I don't have time. I would get into it if I had time. Unfortunately, I don't. But even with all of the godless that the Rebbetzin put into it, and there's no question that what she put into her husband was a very big part of how he became what he became, but still, I cannot fathom it. And he told me, he said, most people, it's the opposite, that when they get married, they learn less than when they were a bachur. But it is possible. Right? And he was not talking about someone that, when he got married, he had a really good wife, and he was mischazik and started learning more, because as a bachur, you know, he wasn't as serious in his learning. He's not talking about that. He's talking about a real masmid. Right? He was obviously talking about himself. Right? He's talking about someone who as a bachur is a real, real masmid. And when he gets married, try for him to learn even more. Yeah, I doubt he's right in front, not mamish in front of him, but off to the side right in front of him, mincha time. And it would be amazing to watch him. He would do like this with the Gemara right after Mincha. Sometimes a little bit before, if he finished Karbanos before Mincha started, he would do like this. Okay? See my finger? He would scan down an Amud like in Kemat seconds. It was mamish unbelievable. Okay, so we talked about his Gadol Tzvitzor. We spoke about how he was a tremendous masmid. We'll talk one more point about the things that we cannot relate to, which is, and then from there we'll get to the part which is probably the most negate to us. His sense of avoida. Chazal tells hibuchach tehei v'nachas, on Shabbos you have to walk calmly, you have to be b'menucha. The only person that I ever saw this, that you could just see that, this is the way Chazal meant it. When he would have us over for Leil Shabbos Suda, so we would usually get to his house about 10 or 15 minutes before he did, even though we would pass him on the street as we were walking to his house, because he would literally stroll together with his, at that time, 9-year-old, 10-year-old son Avrami, as if, you know, he's just got all the time in the world. And you could just see it. You could just see, like, and this was a person who every second counted to him. Literally every second was measured and treasured. And just, he was walking, it's just phenomenal. I'm thinking back and I don't really understand why I didn't, or others didn't take advantage of that to, you know, like talk to him. Maybe it was because he was with his son and we felt like, whatever it was. It was havdik. Shabbos was like a real reality to him. His wife mentioned that a few days before he was murdered on Chof HaYechezrin, which is 1 month before Hanukkah. A few days before that, he was excitedly saying to, in front of his daughters or something, it's almost Shloshim Yom Kadem HaChag. On Hanukkah, he related, as the Sifrei HaChassidus point out, maybe Sifrei Kabbalah also, I have no idea, right, that the Avodah of Hadlakas Neres on Hanukkah is like, the Ramban a little bit is Meramis to this Al HaTorah, is like the Avodah of the Kohen of Hadlakas and Hatavas HaNeres in the Beis HaMikdash. He mamish felt like that. He was a brisker, like a real proper brisker. Many people that are machmirim because they don't know. He was unique in that he was a machmir because he did know, right? Everything that he was doing, it wasn't because he had sfeikus, it was because he was getting another shita, which is shita's brisk. The shita brisk is that you try to get every single shita of the Rishonim. So every single another shita. She said that he lit his Chanukah menorah in so many places that I think she said towards the end of Chanukah, he had a whole crate of oil. You know, most of us, because you use up one bottle, you know, unless, you know, you have a lot of kids and using all of them also. He had a whole crate of oil. And he would use big glasses that were like, some of them, I think for the Shabbos Hanukkah was like maybe this big. The other ones were like, huge, like a very big shear. And he had like 150 of these glasses that needed to be cleaned, you know, for whatever it was last couple of days. And she said to him, you know, the Ozaret is coming, the housekeeper is coming on Sunday. Right? They had apparently someone to help clean on Sunday, you know, so take care of it. And he said, Chas v'shalom, these helig glezelach, his holy glasses. That's the way he related to it. But him, it was a reality. It wasn't just, you know, a mitzvah that you do and go to your party or your donut or your latkes or go back to learning halavai, right? It was very much a reality for him. Yom Kippur, he would say, you know, Shabbos is me'in Olam Haba. Yom Kippur is Olam Haba. You can see my Yom Kippur by the video, he puts his talus over himself. I daven like right near him. And he's just him and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Simchas Purim was phenomenal. Immediately after Purim was over, he would have this small cup. His wife would bring him up, like, apparently really strong coffee. Within a minute, he was sober. At least it looked that way. And you know, he got himself, you know, not like crazy drunk, but like nice and high on Purim. Just, you know, after Purim was over. Around Tammuz time, I remember when we were learning the Tzkuva that we were learning the Chavrusa, he walks into the room where we learned it was like this tiny little Eitz Sfarim in the Vardag. Off of Shmuel Navi Street. So he comes in and I said, good morning, Rabbi, how's everybody doing? He said, I'm just barely managing to keep my head above the water. It's a really hard skufa. Right? Because Tammuz and Av, it's the time of the Avelus and the Churban. And I was like, yeah, you know, it's a really hard skufa. And I was like, I don't know, I feel fine. And he was like, wow, that's amazing that you're managing, you know, to keep yourself, you know, to keep yourself so good during such a skufa. And I was like laughing to myself, like, you know, by him, the tkufa was a reality. Every single yontif, every single calendar day, it was mamash a reality to him. Okay, so these are all the parts that we can't, at least I speak for myself, I assume I speak for most of the people in here, can't really relate to. We can't relate to this incredible godless of synthesizing, you know, the litvish of brisk and the spitz of the olam halita'i and the spitz of the chassidish olam. We can't really relate to this incredible godless betoyah, this incredible asmada, this incredible preachers, this incredible levels of avodas Hashem. But now let's talk about the parts that are that much more phenomenal. Really, everything I said now was a hakdama to get to what I wanted to get to, because you can't really appreciate what I'm about to say unless you know all of the hakdama. He was incredibly devoted to his talmidim. You have to understand, he was an amazingly brilliant person. If we would have left him alone, the amount that he would have been able to accomplish on his own in terms of more shlita on Shas and Paiskim, more amkus, would have been phenomenal. And the whole Zeis, besides giving shiurim every single day, and being their night seder to field questions every single night, which, okay, that was part of his job description. But above and beyond that, came out any single bachur, whether from his shiur or not from his shiur, who asked for a chavrusa shaf, and many, many people. I don't think there was any other Rebbe, in Teres Moshe at least, that came close to this many people wanting to have a chavrusa shaf with him. He would basically make time for everybody. Basically try to make time for everybody. Chavrusa shafs throughout the week, you know, during Ben Hazarim, a little bit during afternoon seder. He would try to make for everybody. During Shir one time, I remember he finished like a whole explanation of a certain point in the Gemara, and then he looks at us and he says, any questions? Silence. He says, now's the time to ask. I've been in other Shirim in my life where if you try to ask during the Shir, the Rebbe does not appreciate it. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. You know, there is a mahalach of Zurek Mara the Talmidim, but he was the opposite. His concern was the Talmidim. He didn't just want to say his shtickle, get it off his chest, and then move right to the next topic. He wasn't just teaching Gemara. He was teaching Talmidim. And that was his focus. His focus was that the Talmidim should know, they should understand, and if they don't, he'll explain it again. And if they still don't understand, he'll explain it again. Because he was such a nister, he was so tsanua about the way he did things, and he was a very private person, he was introverted. You know, his brother, which I mean, if you're a perceptive person, you can see this, but his brother mentioned that by nature, he was a tough, shy person. And he overcame that nature in order to be able to give to his Talmidim what he needed to give, and to other people as well. He was very introverted. He really did not appreciate it when people would ask him about his personal nagas, but the Bachrim apparently could not help themselves. They would constantly pester him about any... I remember there was a guy in my year who any single stupid question that came to his mind, he would ask. And I'm telling you, sometimes I would blush inside from having heard that I cannot believe he just asked me that question. You know, like, do me a favor, like, you know, control your mouth. No, any single question. You know, if it was a personal hanhaga, sometimes he would sidestep it. You know, he didn't necessarily want to, but he would never, ever brush off a question as being silly. You know, sometimes a bachur asks a stupid question and she hears a silly question. He can't help. He laughs up a little bit. Not by him. By him, nothing was a silly question. Sometimes he would sidestep if he felt that it was necessary to sidestep, but not just to brush it off. I once was that nudnik. First day of shiur, so guys were like writing down shiurei, you know, Hagoyim, Rav Moshe Tversky Shlita. So we had a machlokes how to spell his name. Is it with two vavs or is it with a vase? Some guys were saying it's with two vavs, some guys were saying it's with a vase. He walks in the room, he doesn't get a word out of his mouth. I immediately pipe up, how does Rebbe spell his last name? Now, if I would have been the Rebbe, I would have said, Shalom Aleichem, what's your name? He might have not known, he knew my name by then, but whatever. But still, it wasn't exactly, you know, the most bakavadig thing. So he said, it's with a vase. And then he told us a piece of information that made me very happy that I asked the question. He said, the Messiah and the Mishpacha is that we originally, you know, all the way back from some before Korban Abayas, come from Tveria. So that's why it's with a vase. Tversky, I think in Russian, ski means from the place of. One time, one of the guys in the shir was bragging that he got Rebbe to schmooze a little bit about in Mili D'Almo. I think it was a snowstorm that year, and he somehow managed to get a few words out of Rebbe about that. I'm sure that he wasn't really interested in it, but he probably realized that his Talmud so badly wanted to just stop schmooze with him. So he did. This was a person who was constantly pushing himself to his maximum, or at least to a maximum that we cannot relate to. And Aseres Mitzvah, he would always talk about the koyach of Aseres Mitzvah, how every single moment is precious and you have to use every moment. And as almost impossible and as it is to believe that such a thing could be possible, that a person like this could push himself even more, you could see that he was. So there was something I wanted to talk to him once, Ben Hazarim, and I went over to him and I said, does everybody have a minute? You know, a very normal American expression. Do you have a minute? So he looks at me and he says, during Aseres Mitzvah, he doesn't have a minute. But if you need to make the time, you make the time. And that was who he was. I don't have a minute. But if you need me, I'll make the time for you. Because you're my Talmud, or you're someone who needs me. One time, one of his Talmidim, I don't know how far back it had been, right after Shir, we saw someone through the window, and he was like waiting for him. He walks out of the room, he sees this Talmud he hadn't seen for a long time, and he gives him a big hug and smile, and he says, Ra'if anecha laifi lalti. You know, that was the way he expressed himself by, you know, Yaakov, you know, and Yosef HaTzadik. Okay, so he was incredibly devoted to his Talmidim, you know, and he to a certain extent brought himself down to us to be able to, he was very down to earth also. One time he was talking, I think either during Elul, during Aseres Mitzvah, about the inyan of the Yayma, what's the avodas hayayim of Elul, of Aseres Mitzvah, and he said, since Rosh Hashanah is all about Imru Lufanai Malchia, it's Kedesh Yitamichuni Aleichem, it's all about Kedesh Malchia Shemaim. So it makes sense, he said that the inyan of the Yayma, the avodas hayayim should be Malchia Shemaim, Kedesh Malchia Shemaim. So how did he spell this effect for us? We can only imagine how he spelled the effect for himself. You know, how he applied it to himself. But how did he apply that to us? He told us, you know, when you're finished with the sefer, give it to kids, put it back on the shelf, don't leave, like, you know, helter-skelter piles of svarim around. You know, come to time on davening, try to daven, you know, in a respectful manner. This is the way that he gave it over to us. One time, I decided that I needed more vitamin D. Because, you know, yeshiva bachim, they're in the dorm all the time. I was in the dorm. So, you know, and they're in the basement all the time, not getting enough sunlight. So I decided I need more sunlight. So at that time, I was very unknowledgeable about the dangers of the Middle Eastern sun in general, and particularly in the middle of the day. And the only time that I had to do my sunbathing to get my vitamin D was in the middle of the day. Right? Literally. So I would stay out there with a stender and a saber, learning. He walks out, the first day that I was there, he sees me and he says, what are you doing? So I said, I need some sun. So, but it's the middle of the day, it's dangerous. And I, it wasn't above him, you know. You have to understand, one Talmud said that he used to walk him out to his car every day. And sometimes they would walk silently, sometimes he would just stop for like a minute. And this Talmud finally mustered up the courage and said, Rebbe, why are you stopping? So he said, because I'm thinking and learning while walking with the car, and sometimes it gets so complex that I can't keep walking. I don't have the ability to walk and think about what I'm thinking about, so I just stop for a minute so I can finish the thought. So this is what he was doing. But Becholzeis, if he was still aware of what could possibly be something, you know, even though it's very down to earth, very, very gashmiyistic, but he saw it and he pointed it out. And by the way, the Maamar HaMuzker, you know, those of you who know me know that I'm a very independent minded person. I was not the Kabbalah. And he saw it. I was like, I basically shrugged my shoulders and said, I need the sun. And he didn't like tell me, you know, he was a giant in brilliance. Besides his knowledge, he was an incredibly brilliant person. If I would have been the one on the talking end to the Talmud, I would have said, get back inside now. You're going to cause yourself cancer. But that wasn't him. That wasn't the way he was. He told me, he's not going to forcefully apply his opinion. And by the way, in learning also, it was the same thing. He was a giant. One of his favorite expressions was Habaycher Yivchar. He would give one Mahalach in the Sugya, give another Mahalach in the Sugya, the Habaycher Yivchar. You're a Lamdan. You could decide for yourself which Mahalach is the best. Sometimes he would decide which Mahalach makes sense or his own condition, but he would never push it. It would never be like, you know, Kabel Daiti because I'm your Rebbe and you have to be Mekabel. Bechlal not. If Talmidim argued with him, he wouldn't intellectually push them down. He would let them argue. You know, yeah, he would make it clear what he holds, but that's it. You know? Never push them down. Always very soft-spoken. An interesting maestro that once happened. Again, those of you that know me, I mean, you don't know me from my younger years, but you could maybe extrapolate. I'm a very fiery person by nature. We have to finish up? Okay. Maybe I'll say this mice and I'll say one more mice, okay? I'm a very fiery person by nature. And befrat when I was like 18 years old, so like at the drop of a hat, you know, discussing something with a chavrusa, I'm screaming at the top of my lungs. Okay, like, and this was when I was in Yeshiva High School, Greater Washington, I would scream at the top of my lungs the whole day. The whole day. Even when I was learning by myself. Just screaming. So my chavrusa was very intimidated by it. Even though he himself was an intellectual individual. He once told me that when he would tell me something, he would be so betachad how I was going to react to it. Because I would like stop. So he told me once, the first day that we learned together, I immediately started screaming like 5 minutes in. And he goes, why are you screaming? Just like that. So at a certain point I went to someone. And I asked him about it. You know, it's bothering my chavrusa, but this is the way that I learned. So he said to me, like, he said, that's Milcham Tishol Torah, you're right. Milcham Tishol Torah, that's the way you get when you're learning, you're right. But if it bothers him, so try to accommodate him. For some reason, it occurred to me that I should speak to Rabbi Tversky also. Do you want to know what his reaction was? He said to me, Milcham Tishol Torah, and he was not the Mashkiach of the Yeshiva, he was a rabbi. He said to me, Milcham Tishol Torah is no excuse for bad midas. That's what he said to me. I'll tell you one more myself. I could probably go on for hours. I'll tell you one more myself. On Purim, one Purim, he made a very big esek about the meat of Akar Sataif. And the way that he applied it, Lamaisa, in that context, was the Rebbetzin. You're coming to someone's house, you're eating a whole Suda, it's all made very nicely. Realize who made it, Bimakir Taiva. They made a very, very big esek about it. I think it was the following Shabbos. You know, he would always have Bachim over a lot. And it was late when the Suda ended. His Rebbetzin was nowhere around, she probably went to sleep already. He said, thank you. There was one guy left, myself and Yaakov Cooper, for those of you who know, we left. We got down, and I said to Yaakov Cooper, I said, oh no, we forgot to thank the Rebbetzin. Because what I understood, yeah, I could be wrong, I could have been wrong, but I understood that what he meant was, is that if I don't have to say thank you to your Rebbe, you have to say thank you to the one who prepared it. So we went back upstairs, we knocked on the door. Okay, don't forget what I told you about every single second on Shabbos and learning in Asmod and everything. He opens the door and he says, yeah. So I said, we forgot to thank the Rebbetzin. So his eyes open up big and bright. And he says, wow, come inside. I'm like, thinking to myself, what in the world? Right? He says, sit down, I'm going to go get you some ice cream. We just had ice cream, okay? And I was stuffed to the gills, okay? Her food happens to be incredible. She told me that he once told her, you know, they're not coming for me, they're coming for your food. I have another mice about that, but it's not time. And I'm like, Rebbe, no, it's okay. Like, we really don't want ice cream, you know, we're really full. It's like, no, I want to get you an ice cream. And... despite the protest, he went and got two bowls of ice cream for us. He sits down with us, and then he feels bad, and he says, listen, if you really don't want it, you don't have to eat it. So that was who he was. He was at Onuk Shabbat Nakim. And Bechol Zeis, you know, Chaval, I didn't get to his Atznei Alachis. Maybe we'll have a second installment at some point, because it really is Chaval. I only got to, like, a third of what I wanted to get in Nishlah. But, okay, he's a Chaval, he should be a Melech Yeshua for us, and Halavai that we shouldn't need any more tragedies to become aware of great people.